Today we are in the seventh part of a series of sermons on truth versus tradition. And to the best of my ability to think, this lesson will basically conclude all I can think of that would help keep all of us away from falling into religious traditions. We have talked about several things throughout the course of this series, like the fact that people like traditions. So first thing we ought to realize is we're all susceptible to that, that it's long been a problem of humanity to like things that are traditional. And then we talked about Bible authority, how commands and examples and necessary inferences work. And then we made some applications to those things and talked about how things have to be lawful, expedient, and edifying, and also how they have to glorify God. Then we talked about how the church is not the standard. It doesn't matter how good a congregation may appear, no congregation on earth, knowledgeable or not, has the authority from God to create rules. And we talked about how man's individual conscience on matters of authorized liberties are things that can be used to discern right from wrong individually. And then we took that lesson into the difference between individual, concurrent, and collective action. And all of those principles, when you put all of those things together and you funnel any Bible study through them, you're going to come down to the right conclusion. You're going to apply things like, I'm not going to do anything I doubt about. All those lessons that we've covered thus far, those are going to bring you down to a conclusion of how to study the Bible and come to the right result, the end result. How to rightly divide the word of truth. Did God command me to do it? Did He show me an approved example? Did He infer it? How's that fit into other scriptures? What's the application of that? And so forth. So in this lesson, we're gonna talk about one other issue that is related to all the others, but often it becomes traditional practices. And then next week, I plan on wrapping up the series with kind of a potpourri of applications. Because if I just talked about every tradition just among churches of Christ, I think probably it'd be like 2022, and we'd be on part whatever in the hundreds. I just really don't want to keep doing that, arming you with the right scriptural ways to discern right from wrong. And next week we'll make some applications of things that we need to be aware of. But the traditions are so far spread among so many different divisions of, I'm going to use some loose terminology, different brands of churches of Christ. You got your liberals, your ultra liberals, your conservatives, your all these things that get put into a melting pot. There's just so much. Today, the proper usage of the Lord's money and just titling that this lesson, part seven, properly using the Lord's money. There are some people that would conclude, well, no, there's no such thing as the Lord's money. That all money, everything belongs to God. So there's no difference between my money and the Lord's money. So we really do need to start there. That in the Bible, God shows us a difference between what has been purposed to Him. And that's a key word. I want you to remember that word purposed, because that's a key word that we're going to talk about again in a moment. Because as we address some of these scriptures here, it's not just what's sitting in the treasury, so to speak, but what's purposed to Him as applications to these things as well. We're going to start in Acts chapter 4. If you open your Bibles to Acts 4, verse 34. And we're going to go through chapter 5, verse 11. And there's only a few verses in here that I really am purposing to address. Nonetheless, I want you to get the whole context. So in Acts 4, beginning of verse 34, neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the prices of the things that were sold, laid them down at the apostles' feet. Distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. And Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite in the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it, brought the money, and laid it at the apostles' feet. Chapter 5. But a certain man named Ananias, with Sapphira his wife, sold the possession, and kept back part of the price, his wife also being privy to it, and brought a certain part, and laid it at the apostles' feet. Peter said, Ananias, why has Satan filled thine heart to lie to the Holy Ghost and keep back part of the price of the land? Whiles it remained. Now here's the key verse, really, of this whole context. He says, while it remained, was it not thine own? So while it was yours, it was yours. Why didn't you do with it what you wanted, right? Isn't that going to be the conclusion of this statement? He says, after it was sold, was it not in thine own power? So even after you sold the land and you've had this money in your possession was under your authority, why hast thou conceived in thine heart? Thou hast not lied unto men, but unto God. This is where purpose comes in. You know, beginning in Acts 4:34, they sold their land for a purpose, to do the Lord's work. Now, they purposed something, they carried it out, but in the midst kept back part of what they had purposed to God. If you continue to read verse 5, Ananias, hearing these words, fell down and gave up the ghost, and great fear came on all them that heard these things. And the young men arose, wound him up, and carried him out and buried him. It was about the space of 3 hours after, when his wife, not knowing what was done, came in. Peter answered to her, tell me whether you sold the land for so much. And she said, yea, for so much. Peter said to her, how is it that you have agreed together to tempt the Spirit of the Lord? Behold, the feet of them which buried their husband at the door, and shall carry thee out. Then fell she down straightway at his feet, yielded up the ghost. The young men came in and found her dead, carrying her forth, buried her by her husband. And great fear came upon all the church, as many as heard these things. Clearly, you can see there's a difference between your money and what has been purposed to be given to God, even before it's been given to him. And we're going to talk more about that word, and I'm going to prove that out a little bit more as we continue through some more of these verses. But the fact of Ananias and Sapphira and the context of which that shows should give us, if nothing else, great pause, great thought and consideration. What they had done, they were in part of a plan to sell land and bring it to the Lord's work, and they kept back part of that. Giving to God isn't just the same as my money being my money all the time and his money being his money, being all money is his anyways. Clearly, there's a difference, and a significant one. And there's a difference in oversight. While as was thine own, was it not under thine own power? There's a difference with what I can see as oversight of my funds and what belongs to God. That's part of why we did this lesson after we talked about individual, concurrent, and collective action. I have to understand there's a difference between I and we and even us as a collective body. Well, there's a difference between mine and his. There are some things that I labor for, I earn that belong to me, other things I purpose to him. And God's consideration, God's mindset, I want to use an Old Testament context here. Go back to Malachi chapter 3. And I understand we're not under the old law. This is just to establish God's mindset towards things that have been purposed to him. Malachi 3, 8 through 10. God says, will a man rob God? Yet ye have robbed me. But you say, wherein have we robbed thee? In tithes and offerings. Ye are cursed with a curse, for ye have robbed me, even this whole house. Bring ye all the tithes in the storehouse, that there may be meat in mine house, and prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, and there shall not be room enough to receive it. So God views, when you keep back what belongs to him, what's been purposed to him, he views that as stealing from him. You've robbed me and things that belong to me. Now, again, I understand tithing is an Old Testament command, Deuteronomy 12, verse 6. So I'm not trying to apply this, please hear that. Not trying to apply this directly to us today, just in principle, that what has been purposed to God, God views as you're a crook, you've taken it from me. It's proven that he still thinks that way because of Acts 4:34 through chapter 5 and verse 10. Even further than that, tithing was much more than just about money. You know, they gave of their flocks and their possessions. Luke 27:32, we're no longer under the law of Moses. It was more than, you know, people still today, they try to apply this tithing principle. Listen, it was a tenth of everything they owned. It wasn't a tenth of what they made this week after taxes. It was a tenth of everything they owned and all their prosperity and their crops and everything else. And God wanted the first fruits. And there's principles that apply. God's a first fruit God. He's not, doesn't belong at the end of our lives, our budgets, or anything else. We're supposed to seek Him first. Matthew 6 and verse 33. But the specific command of tithing is not a command today. And I think we all understand that. I just brought that up in case there's a question. Back to the point of our lesson. The word purposed. What you see in Ananias and Sapphira. What you saw in Malachi chapter 3. The word purposed. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 9. This is in a context, chapters 8 and 9, of the church in Corinth being called upon to do what they were commanded to do in 1 Corinthians 16 and helping poor saints in Jerusalem. In that context, 2 Corinthians 9, 6 and 7. Says, but I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap sparingly, he which soweth bountifully shall reap bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. The New Testament command of giving isn't about a tenth. It's about purpose. You know, in Acts 4, 34 through 5, 11, it was all of that they sold their lands and houses for. That's what they had purposed to give unto God. When they lied and held back part of the price, they should have never purposed it to begin with. It was under power not to do that. You know, sometimes people look at Acts 4 and they'll say, oh, so a Christian has to sell their house? No, a Christian doesn't have to sell his or her house. Philemon had a house. Philemon in verse 2 had servants, etc., etc., etc. That's misapplying the scriptures, right? That's somebody just pulling one thing out of its context and saying, well, they sold that. That was a different case. Now, if here we in El Paso, all of a sudden, all of us were stricken with poverty and we had brethren from all over the country coming to live here, some of us might need to sell our homes to be able to help financially aid and support those brethren. We might all have to move in with Sheila and like the bees did not long ago in her house. Might have to overtake her house and live with her. Some of us might have to sell our land, come together and yeah, I know, she's shaking her head. Come on, of course, I know. That's why I used her as an example. She wouldn't care. We'd just all bunk out in the living room. Popcorn and donuts, right? We'd be good to go. But if I purposed that I'm going to do this, I'm going to give this to the Lord, as I've purposed in my heart, so let me give. That's the consistency. That's what you see in Malachi 3. It's what you see in Acts 4, 34 through 5, 11. It's what you see here in 2 Corinthians 9, 6, and 7. That's rightly dividing the word of truth, making sure that I'm following the pattern, making sure I'm coming to the right conclusion. We give as we've purposed. Now, I think we all know this, but let's look at 1 Corinthians 16. Make 2 points out of 1 Corinthians 16 for us to consider. 1 Corinthians 16 verses 1 and 2. I couldn't believe anyone here would have a question on this, but nonetheless. It says, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I've given order to the churches of Galatia, even so do ye. So it's a command, not just case specific. Upon the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by in store as God is prospering, that there be no gatherings when I come. So we have the command to give as we've purposed. When? On the first day of the week. Now, another point to add to this. Once we give, God has always expected what we give to Him not to be stored up, so to speak, but to be used for His work. Look at the next two verses here in 1 Corinthians 16. Verses 3 and 4, Paul speaking, when I come, whomsoever you shall approve by your letters, them will I send to bring your liberality into Jerusalem. If it be meet that I go also, that they shall go with me. There's a purpose. You know, we don't have authority from God to just collect money and store it, just to allow it just to become the Church of Christ savings account. When the Lord returns, there are churches all over this country. One time I spoke to a congregation prior to moving here. And they were looking for an evangelist to come work with them. And they told me rather boastfully how many hundreds of thousands of dollars that they had in the treasury. And that they had basically no purpose for it at all. And I said, well, you know, I know of several gospel preachers that could use support. Whether I come and work with you or not, how about I give you their names? Oh, no, no, no. We're just saving this up. Because, you know, times will get tough at some point. Or the Lord's going to come tomorrow. What are you saving His money up for? It was meant to be used. It was meant purpose to put into application. There are people that rightfully could use the Lord's money as He intended it. Don't just store it up. Don't just say, hey, we're going to just set it aside and, you know, build up this account. We see what happens with that, right? People will take advantage of those types of things. So as you've purposed in your heart on the first day of the week, that money's supposed to be used. That's true even under the old law. Look back to the book of Nehemiah. And again, this is just to show consistency. We're not under the old law. It's just to show the consistency. God wants His money to be used, to be put to good use. Nehemiah chapter 10. Verses 32 and 33 says, also, we made ordinances for us to charge ourselves yearly with a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God, for the showbread, for the continual meat offering, the continual burnt offering of the Sabbaths, of the new moons, for the set feasts, for the holy things, for the sin offerings to make atonement for Israel, and for all the work of the house of our God. So it's a consistent pattern, and you could put a lot more verses to it. It's a consistent pattern. All the New Testament alike, the money that has been purposed and given has to be used towards the Lord's work. Now, if I just stop there, I don't know how you'd err if you're an honest person. An honest person should be able to hear that lesson at this point and be ready to make always the right decision. If it's not the Lord's work, don't touch His money. That should be the simplistic conclusion of a lesson like this. But, you know, that's just not how it is. People can hear those simple points. They can read the verses that we've read and still go out and use the Lord's money like it's theirs. Like they're the decision makers. So I'm going to give you some other principles and then we'll get into some specifics. Look at Hebrews chapter 3. I'll pick on Rick since he's sitting in the back there. I can't imagine if I walked into Rick's house and I was like, hey, Rick, you know what? I think you need a new leather recliner. One of these, you know, $2,000 leather recliners with massage and speakers. And I saw one of these on the internet. Speakers and the headrest. He's like, oh. Can't imagine if I said, you need one of those. And, oh, and while you're at it, let's go ahead and paint your living room pink with purple polka dots. Now, I know I got something there that he wouldn't go for. And your TV, it's not big enough. Let's just go ahead and knock out this wall and let's put up a 200-inch screen and a projector in the back. I mean, imagine you're going to have these speakers, you know, right in your head. And your chair's going to be massaging you and all these other things. You know, he's going to say, really? Whose house do you think this is? And can you imagine if I'm like, hey, where's your checkbook at? What do you want my checkbook? Well, I got to pay for this somehow, you know. So give me your checkbook. I'm going to go down to the furniture store and I'm going to order all this stuff up for you. You know, it's going to be like $8,000. I don't really know that that's what it would cost. But let's just say, you know, we're going to get the best pink and purple paint you ever did see. Make sure that when you're in that room, it's like, whew. Just all kinds of Pepto-Bismol feeling going on. And you're watching that movie and you're just, heads just, you know, the chairs, you know, imagine one of those nice explosions in the middle of a movie. And then he's like, I don't hear anything going on in my house anymore. Yeah, the kids are like, cool. So you got all this stuff If I walked over and I start writing a check to whatever ABC furniture store, Rick's going to say, what are you doing with my checkbook? No, how is it any different in the Lord's house? The church is His house. Hebrews 3 and verse 6 says, but Christ as a son over His own house, whose house are we if we hold fast the confidence and rejoice in the firm unto the end? There's a principle there. We are the Lord's house. We have our own houses to oversee. You know, one of the qualifications of an elder in 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 4 and 5, one of the qualifications is one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. For if a man know not how to rule his own house, how shall he take care of the church of God? You have your house. I have mine. We make our decisions what color we want on the walls, whether or not we want to spend $2,000 on a chair or $4,000 on a 200-inch screen and a projector and all these other things. Those are decisions we make. We don't want other people coming into our house taking our checkbook and saying, here's what I'm going to spend your money to buy you. The church is the Lord's house. The money we collect on the first day of the week is His money. The principle is the same. When we come into the Lord's house and we just start deciding, hey, we're going to take the Lord's money and we're just going to start doing A, B, C, D, E, and F, well, we better make sure, is that what He wants in His house? Is that really His work? I mean, look at Ephesians chapter 1. Sometimes people will make statements. The bulletin article today is a good side to what we're about to address. Sometimes people say, well, the elders have decided. Who do the elders think they are? Or the men have voted. Who do the men think they are? You know, if elders walk into your house and grab your checkbook and say, we're spending $8,000 on some reconstruction of your living room, I'm pretty confident you're going to say, I don't care who you think you are, but you're not taking my checkbook. Ephesians 1, beginning of verse 19 says, now therefore, ye are no more strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints in the household of God, are built upon the foundation. This is Ephesians 2. Foundation of apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom all the building fitly framed together groweth unto a holy temple of the Lord, in whom ye are builded together for an habitation of God through the Spirit. We are God's building. We are His house. He's the head of it, Ephesians 1, 22 and 23. Christ is the head of the church. He's the head of us. It's His money. He's in charge. It's His house. How do you go in and say, well, we voted to do this? Or, well, the elders have decided that this is a good idea. You know what preachers will do? Preachers, I tell you what, when a preacher starts to say, let's show what history tells us, I guarantee you what he's teaching is false doctrine all the time. If he can't go to the Bible and say, here's what the Bible says, if he's got to go and say, well, let me show you what they did, historically. Well, why can't you go to the Bible? How come the Bible is the standard on what you must do to be saved, but not on the Lord's money or these other issues? You got to go to history and you got to say, oh, in the third century, this they call them church fathers or something along that line. I don't know where that puts God, but nonetheless, they'll say the church fathers wrote this book where they were doing this as the Lord's church. Well, I'll tell you where they erred. They wrote the book. The book is here. How do we spend the Lord's money? Or whatever else it is. That preacher who has to say, well, brethren have done this in the second or third century, or history denotes this, or, well, for hundreds of years this has been the practice. Where's the Bible teach it? If I walk into your house and I say, you know, for hundreds of years, Christian men have liked 200-inch television screens. I mean, you know that's false anyway. But nonetheless, if that's my argument, is that going to mean that you're going to just fess up your checkbook for $8,000? Oh, okay. Well, since you put it that way, since other people have done it, then good. Yeah, go ahead. Take my checkbook. No. You're going to say, this is my house. I don't care what they did in the past. That's the Lord's way of thinking. This is His house. He doesn't care what men do. Can't serve God and men. Galatians 1 verse 10. He doesn't care what men do in the sense of, let me qualify this. He cares what men do in the sense of accountability and everything else. But as far as authority goes, it's His word. And His word only that makes the application. So He's the head of the church. When we're stepping back and we're thinking, how are we going to spend the Lord's money? Colossians 1 verse 10. Colossians 1 and verse 10 says that you might walk worthy of the Lord unto all pleasing, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. Aren't we bound by that? To be all pleasing to God? Look at Hebrews chapter 13, verses 20 and 21. It says, now the God of peace that brought again from the dead our Lord Jesus, that great shepherd of the sheep, through the blood of the everlasting covenant, make you perfect in every good work to do His will, working you that which is well-pleasing in His sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. We're to be doing what is pleasing in His sight. I'm taking His money. I'm hit in His house. I need to do what's pleasing in His sight. I need to go to the head of the church and make sure that this is acceptable. So with these principles, the fact that it is the Lord's money, you oversee yours, but He's the head of the church. There are some applications to make. How do we arrive at authority? You know, the most primary work of the church is to spread the gospel. That's clearly the significant work of the church. The first focus that is there. Without the spreading of the gospel, nobody's going to heaven, and all things, everything else is in vain. So that brings about questions like evangelist. What do you do with evangelist? How are they supported? Look at 2 Corinthians 11. Let's start talking about the specifics. What ways did the church step up in supporting evangelists? 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 8 said, I robbed other churches, taking wages of them to do you service. Now here is a very simple verse that leads you to clear conclusions. One or more congregations can support a man who's preaching the gospel. One or more. Churches, a plurality of. Paul was working in Corinth. They should have been supporting him. He didn't take support from them. He took support from others to do service toward them at the point he's making reference here. Gospel preachers are worthy of financial support. You know, if you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 1 through 14 give us quite a few things that a gospel preacher, a man preaching the gospel, can have a wife. Verse 5. Verse 6, though, says, or I only and Barnabas, have we not power to forbear working? Who goeth a warfare at any time in his own charges? Who planteth a vineyard and eateth not of the fruit thereof? Who feedeth the flock and eateth not of the milk of the flock? Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? So Paul is going to do similarly as I've done this lesson. Look at this principle even in the Old Testament. It's been consistent all the way through. And here he quotes, for it is written in the law of Moses, thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for the oxen? Or saith he altogether for our sakes, for our own sakes, no doubt, that it is written, he that ploweth should plow in hope, and he that thresheth in hope should be partakers of his hope. If we have sown unto you spiritual things, is it a great thing if we reap your carnal things? If other be partakers of this power over you, are we not rather? Nevertheless, we have not used this power, but suffer all things, lest we should hinder the gospel of Christ. So again, they weren't supporting him. He was taking support from other congregations. Verse 13. Do you not know that they which minister about the holy things live of the things of the temple? And they which the altar, the partakers of the altar, again, he references the old law, the Levites. And then verse 14 makes the application. Even so the Lord hath ordained that they which preach the gospel should live of the gospel. So you have churches supporting. It's a authorized work in Philippians chapter 4. Beginning in verse 11, I've always found verse 11 fascinating, because anytime somebody preaching the gospel starts to talk about money, You know how they can be perceived? Oh, you just want more money. So verse 11, Paul says, not that I speak in respect of want, for I've learned in whatsoever state I am therewith to be content. It's kind of shameful that that has to be said, but I get it. He says in verse 12, I know both how to be abased, I know how to abound. Everywhere in all things I'm instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. Just a little side point. I remember talking to Bill Wright the first time that I talked to him about coming here and preaching. And about 30 minutes into me expressing that I'd be interested in coming to meet the congregation, he said, well, before you come, let's talk about money. And I said, no, I don't want to talk about money. I said, I don't ever want to talk about money. Let's just make it about the Lord's work and you guys do what you can to support me and we'll make ends meet somewhere. And he said, well, he says, listen, brother, he says, we've had men that have come here and they won't come because we don't pay enough. I know Marty remembers Bill and I having a similar discussion at their dinner table the first time that we came down here to finish. I'm bringing that up for this reason. Anytime a man starts talking about preaching and he talks about money, you have to watch him. Because there are some people that only preach for money. Those are false teachers, 2 Peter 2:1-3. They make merchandise of the people. So if a man is preaching the gospel and he's making it about money, you've got a very big potential problem. I'm not saying all the time, but possibly a big potential problem. You've got to be careful in those regards. Paul here has the right attitude. He's going to preach regardless, support or not. He's going to continue to preach the gospel no matter what. See that in Acts 18 where he's willing to make tents to make ends meet. Whatever he's going to do, he's going to continue to preach the gospel. You're never going to take the gospel out of him. He's not going to go get a degree to be a school teacher like some area false teachers have. He's not going to rest on those kinds of principles. He will pick up a tool to do work if he needs to support himself temporarily. But he most of the time throws himself at the mercy of the brethren with the Lord's money. So that's his mindset. Now back to the point. Verse 14. He says, notwithstanding, ye have well done that ye did communicate with my affliction. Now, you Philippians know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church communicated me as giving and receiving, but ye only. So think about all the congregations Paul was helping. How many of them offered to support him? Just Philippi. Isn't that a sad statement? I'll tell you what, not much has changed. Verse 16. For even in Thessalonica, you sent once again unto my necessity. Now, notice verse 17. Not because I desire a gift, but I desire fruit that may abound to your account. So there's a mutual relationship in the support of a preacher. When a congregation takes that effort on, it's fruitful for them. It's a good work. That's the point of verse 17. So Paul says, by you supporting me, you're helping me, but you're helping you too. That congregation is helping itself in the eyes and the sight of the Lord God, Jehovah. Now, incorporated in supporting evangelists. Look at Acts 11 and another thing. I know Todd has asked me about this before. In fact, I had it specifically written down, I should say typed out, in a note to myself. What about missionaries? What about men who, you know, I'm sure you've heard that term before, have been called missionaries. They go and somewhere else. You know, that term's not in the Bible. Neither is the general way it's used today. What we're about to see is the pattern. If somewhere needs the gospel and there's no preacher there that's capable of doing it, here's the pattern. You ready? Acts 11, beginning of verse 20. Some of them were men of Cyprus and Cyrene, whom when they were come to Antioch, spake unto the Grecians, preaching the Lord Jesus. And the hand of the Lord was with them, and a great number believed and turned unto the Lord. Then tidings of these kings came unto the ears of the church that was in Jerusalem, and they sent forth Barnabas that he should go as far as Antioch, who when he was came had seen the grace of God, was glad, and exhorted them all, purpose of the heart, they would cleave unto the Lord. So here's the pattern. If somewhere needs the gospel, we have authority as a congregation. You can send me to go and teach. You can support me to go and teach those people. I know back, I think it was in July or something, I made some of the brethren aware that that I'm studying with a guy in Virginia that may need help starting a congregation at some point in the area of Virginia that he lives. That would be the way it's done. It's not, well, we're going to go send a missionary. There's no such thing as Barnabas. Same thing you see in Acts 15 with the church in Jerusalem sending men back to Antioch and carrying out the teaching of the Word of God. What has happened today is there has been this separation of, instead of just gospel preachers, they call them missionaries. And then they form a whole new work of the church. Go and live somewhere. Now, that term's used broadly, too. There's not enough time in this sermon to cover how it's used. There are people that will talk about, you know, foreign missionaries and this missionary and that missionary. Listen, the gospel's supposed to be preached in all the world. It's not to be isolated to certain areas. On a side note, though, I always find it funny, and not in a ha-ha kind of way, that I will read letters from men in the United States who get on airplanes and fly to different countries. And they're not even doing the work of preaching in their own neighborhood. You know, they want the $15,000 that they're going to get for going to the Philippines and preaching the gospel. And on the way to the DFW airport, they pass 100 miles of area where there's no churches of Christ. And they act like they have to go to the Philippines to preach the gospel. There's a great deal of hypocrisy in all these things that have been started and formed by men. There are people that want to go to a foreign country to preach the gospel, right? I know men that live in Texas that glory in going to the Philippines. Mexico's right across the river. You want to go preach the gospel in a foreign country? You can do it via automobile. You don't even have to get on a plane and fly somewhere else. And then these guys, they go for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks. You know what happens on week 5? They leave. You know what happens to the congregation that they started in week 5? If you're going to go somewhere and preach the gospel, you got to be invested into that. So there's all kinds of side issues that are related to this. The fact is, they sent men. That's authorized. No other pattern. No creating a new work of the church. No creating. There's also missionary societies. Here in Texas, we have the Herald of Truth Foundation, where they're a missionary society, where you churches send money to them, and then they send preachers. This organization sends preachers, not even preachers. They call them missionaries. Biblically, that's just not the term that's used. An evangelist should be the biblical word. But they send men from that money that they collect. And of course, they fund their organization and they have a paper and all these other things. None of that happened in the Bible. The local church sent a man from there to go and preach. That was the beginning and end of it. It wasn't something else. Paul and Barnabas, when Acts 13, when they left Antioch, And they went and preached the gospel. You know what they did in Acts 14, 27? They came back to Antioch. They gathered together the church and gave a report. So they leave in Acts 13, 1. They go out preaching the gospel for an extended period of time. They come back and report to the church what they've done. That's actually when they recognized that the spread of circumcision as a law had been taught and had to start dealing with that, right? So there's the pattern. Go and preach. Nothing else. There's no form an organization, no, you know, other kind of subsidiaries that are started. There's also authority. Look at Acts chapter 8. There's a division among churches of Christ. In fact, here in Texas, and I know it happens among congregations in Mexico. It happens here in the U.S. It's called the mutual edification doctrine, where they don't believe in a local gospel preacher, where it's just, one man maybe lives in an area and he goes and preaches among 15 churches of Christ or 20 in the Denton area. There's a guy up there that it's almost like Catholicism. There's 2 or 3 preachers. The Denton Church of Christ is like this. There's 2 or 3 preachers that they go around to these 15 to 20 congregations in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And they're the authorities. They're like the modern-day apostles for those churches of Christ in that area. In the meantime, the men of the congregation just take turns preaching. And they don't believe that a preacher can live in one community and teach in one community for any period of time. He has to always be going. He has to always be gone. Is there authority for, like here, I live here. I work in other places, have a lot of Bible studies going on, but I live here. So we're going to address that question. Acts 8:40 says, now I think you all realize what happens in Acts 8:26 through 40. Philip teaches the Ethiopian eunuch. He's converted into Christ. In Acts 8:40, Philip was found at Azotus. Passing through, he preached in all the cities till he came to Caesarea. So in Acts 8:40, you got Philip the evangelist, right? He was one of the seven. He ends up in Caesarea. What's he do from there? You go all the way to Acts chapter 21. Years later. Verse 8. The next day, we that were of Paul's company departed and came into Caesarea and entered in the house of Philip the evangelist, which was one of the seven, and abode with him. What did Philip do? He stayed in Caesarea. He didn't continue to go and preach all around the world. That's not to say he wouldn't have made trips anywhere. I think any preacher worth his salt, if given the opportunity to preach the gospel to somebody who's lost, will go wherever he can go to do so. But the fact is, he had a house, he abode in Caesarea. So here's the pattern of what the church can do with its money in regards to preachers. Support them. Support preachers, local or otherwise. A congregation can send money like Paul. The church in Philippi sent money to him even when he wasn't in Philippi. And we have easy means to do that now. It's a shame that it's not done in a rightful manner. But outside of that, you know what you find the church funding as far as evangelism goes? Nothing else. The people that will form the category of evangelism, right? And then they'll say, well, this is evangelism and this is not in the Bible. It's not listed in the scriptures. And I have seen churches that have, you know, like 20 things under this is evangelism, this is evangelism. Therefore, the Lord's money can be used on A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, all the way down. No, that's not evangelism. Supporting the evangelist is the work that the Lord's money goes toward towards evangelism. I've even heard people say us meeting on the first day of the week is evangelism. No, this isn't evangelism. We come together to worship the Lord and be edified. That's not that there can't be non-believers among us. There was non-believers in the assembly in 1 Corinthians chapter 14. But I'm telling you, somebody walks in here today to hear the gospel for the first time, I'm not doing the work of evangelism today. I'm doing the work of evangelism when I set up a Bible study with them to meet with them outside of this assembly and focus on teaching that person. This is not the work of evangelism. This is not us going out in the world and preaching the gospel. This is us meeting at a central location to worship God and do as we see in Acts 27 through 11. People will take the support of preachers in Memphis, Tennessee. I don't know why I've drawn a blank on the name of the congregation, but a congregation in Memphis, Tennessee has formed a school of preaching called the Memphis School of Preaching. It's under the oversight of the elders of that congregation, and therefore they believe they can take all the funds collected on the first day of the week and put it towards that school. Now, they also accept outside contributions because they call the school an adjunct of the church when it comes to them using the treasury. But then they separate it from the church when they start selling books and all these other things. It's kind of one of those, oh, it is part of the church until we want to do something that's not the work of the church. And now it's not part of the church anymore. One of those, you know, kind of like you're in a street in New York and you see the guy that puts the little ball under the peanuts and he moves it around. Which one's it under? Which one's it under? That's how they play with the Lord's word. Nonetheless, they've started a whole preaching school and they say this is the work of evangelism. Put that to the scriptural test. What church in the first century ever formed a school? None. What church in the first century ever supported a school? Well, there wasn't any schools to support. Why didn't it happen? It wasn't an authorized work. If it were a good work, you know, the scriptures tell us every good work, 2 Timothy 3:16-17. If it were a good work, there would have been the Jerusalem School of Preaching. I mean, the apostles were there. What better instructors If you know you were to get your preacher degree, who do you want your preacher degree from? Think about it. I got a preaching degree signed by the Apostle Paul, right? Signed by the Apostle Peter. Yeah, he was my instructor on how to properly preach the gospel. That's not the way it was done. No. When you look at the pattern in the book of Acts, Paul took Timothy and Silas and Silvanus and others. They went with him preaching the gospel. That's how they were taught how to preach the gospel. They weren't taught by sitting in a classroom for X amount of hours per day and getting a certificate at the end of completion of all those, kind of back to what we were talking about, qualifications earlier. You can go to any school of men, and all that proves is that you can go to a school of men. That doesn't mean that you're a Christian, let alone a faithful Christian, let alone capable of reasoning and teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. So many things that people throw into the work of evangelism, publications. There are churches that will buy tons of these publications and they'll say, it's the work of evangelism. Now, why aren't you, just, the Bible sufficient? Let those preachers who are supported, let them fund their work. That's the work of a preacher. Like I have my own personal website. The church here doesn't contribute one penny to anything I do and read. That's my work as an evangelist. That's me trying to reach more people with the gospel. The church isn't paying for that. Churches aren't paying for that. I've had churches offer to pay, and I tell them, no, it's my work. I'm going to do it. I've been doing that website since 1999. I'm going to continue to do it as long as I am financially capable. If I'm not financially capable anymore, it's going to come down. I'm not going to give a bill to the church and say, here, you need to take on this work. The church's work is to support me as evangelist. I will do what I can with whatever I'm supported with to spread the gospel. I'm not going to ask for the church to pay for the paper that I use to print the bulletin or the handouts that I pass out. If you don't know that, congregation here doesn't support any of that directly. That's my work as an evangelist, as a teacher. I supply all of those things. The church ought to support me so that I can do things like that. But it doesn't have to pick up those bills. So I think you could see how this could go on for like 6 more hours. I don't intend to do so. You've seen the whole pattern. What we've talked about here, that's it. Anything else is an addition. There's nothing else to add. So outside of supporting preachers, look at 1 Timothy chapter 5. Elders can be supported. And you know, here's another sad disclaimer. Most elders that you'll meet today in churches of Christ aren't doing the work of elders, right? They're not overseeing the flock. You know, I have said for the years that I've been here that we're crippled as a congregation not having elders. Having elders is significant. There's work that needs done in this congregation that is not being done because we don't have elders. Work that they'd be capable of doing that I'm not capable and not even going to try to take on the work of overseeing a congregation. That's not the role of a gospel preacher. But those elders, if they're doing the real work, they're not going to have time to hold down full-time jobs. They're not going to have time to go to work until 6 or 7 p.m. and then shepherd the flock after that. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, 17 and 18. Let the elders that rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially they who labor in the word and doctrine. For the scripture saith, thou shalt not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn, and the laborer is worthy of his reward. Elders are worthy of support. And if they're doing the real work of an elder, those guys are going to be busy. They're going to see things and be part of things. They're going to be sitting down with people and studying with them, working with people on a spiritual basis. That's what they're capable of doing, and they ought to be supported so that they can do it. Rather, today, what you see is elders who end up working full-time, and problems in the church get put off for weeks and months because those elders are too busy to address them, too busy to be part of going and working on those problems, and that's going to lead to the downfall of many. So in the future, we have elders. They're worthy of support and ought to be if they're going to do the real work of the Lord's body. That doesn't mean they can't work, but in most congregations, they're going to be pretty busy. And that's also, just like a preacher, they have to be faithful. But elders on another degree have specific qualifications. 1 Timothy 3, 1 through 7, Titus 1, 5 through 9. So before those elders can be supported financially, they have to be sure that they are qualified men. One other thing to keep in mind here is elders are not evangelists. They don't get sent to another congregation. They don't go out. They shepherd the flock. Look at 1 Peter 5. I want us to understand that there's a difference in the work of elders and those of gospel preachers slash evangelists. The elders, 1 Peter 5:1-3, Peter says, "The elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ and a partaker of the glory should be revealed. Feed the flock of God," notice, "which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock." Elders have a local specific task, not a broad task of teaching or preaching. They're going to be local. They're going to be here. If we had elders, they're going to be here. They're going to be overseeing this congregation. If a problem arises in another congregation, those elders would say, "Hey, Brian, go. We got it here. You go. You deal with that." That's what the pattern shows us. That's what Acts 15 shows us. That's what Acts 13 and 14 show us. That's what we read in Acts 11. The elders didn't go. They sent the evangelists go and deal with these particular issues. When it comes to supporting elders, we never see anything where other congregations can be involved. So if there's elders, you know, in Tennessee that are trying to be elders and they can't, they need support, we don't have authority to support them from here. We do evangelists, 2 Corinthians 11:8. But among that congregation, those elders only have authority from God to be supported directly, not through other congregations. So there's another class difference in what is to be expected when it comes to the discussion of supporting elders. The third thing we talk about that we can that we're authorized to use the Lord's money for is what we talked about in 2 Corinthians chapters 8 and 9. And I know we didn't read 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, but let's go ahead and pick up a couple of verses so that you can see this. In 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 1 beginning, 2 Corinthians 8:1-4, says, "Moreover, brethren, we do you to wit of the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia, how that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For to their power I bear record, yea, and beyond their power they were willing of themselves, praying with us much entreaty that we should receive the gift and take upon us the fellowship of the ministering to the saints." So here's the context of 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. It's about helping needy saints. Chapter 9 and verse 1 continues as touching the ministering to the saints. It's superfluous for me to write unto you. So we have authority to use the Lord's money to minister to the saints, to help needy brethren. Now there's language and there's qualifications that are there. I'm going to borrow off of your memory. You remember last week we read 1 Timothy 5:3-16 about helping widows that are widows indeed. And we learned about how there's a difference between individual, concurrent, and collective action in that context. Remember, individually, if a nephew have a widow, let that person take care of him. If a man his own house, take care of it. If there be multiple people, take care of it. The last thing is that the church be charged, 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16. So it's definitely the secondary work of using the treasury. It's not the first thing that you're going to see done. What you saw in Acts 4 and 5 and what we see in 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 9 is helping needy saints, helping them to get through things that they're facing. Look at Romans 15, just a good bit of language that helps in clarity. Romans 15:25-27. It says, "But now I go on to Jerusalem to minister unto the saints. For it pleased them in Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints which are at Jerusalem. It hath pleased them, verily their debtors they are, for the Gentiles have been made partaker of the spiritual things. Their duty is to minister unto them in carnal things." The poor saints which are at Jerusalem. These aren't people who just went out and bought Lincoln Town Cars and can't afford their payments. These are people that are poor saints, not people who... I know one time, I can't remember the specifics, so I'll just give the broad memory I have. I was once asked a member of a congregation confess sin and said that they went and gambled away all their money over a weekend party. And they wanted to know if the congregation should help that person since they're broke. It's like, really? No, it wasn't people who went out and partied over the weekend with their paycheck that they got on Friday. And then Sunday they come to realize, oh, I'm broke. Let me come to the congregation and get some help. No, it's not that at all. It's the poor saints that are at Jerusalem. Look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. There's a specific qualifier. And embedded in this qualifier are some necessary inferences. 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. There's some things that are necessarily, we have to draw from this, as well as what's stated. 2 Thessalonians 3:10 says, for even a... for even when we are with you, this we command you, that if any man would not work, neither should he eat. So when we're talking about people that the Lord's money can be used for, and this just isn't the Lord's money either. This is just, this would apply to us individually. That's really the context. We're not talking about people who are poor because they're lazy. We're not talking about people who are poor because they're negligent or sinful. Talk about people who really have need, who are genuinely honest, faithful brethren. And the principles of 1 Timothy 5:3-16, embedded in that the church be not charged. Clearly, it's not just somebody says, I need my rent paid, let's write them a check. Or somebody says, I need this, let's write them a check and let's just let it go. You know what you never find in the scriptures? You never find the church ever helping somebody who's not a needy saint, a gospel preacher, or an elder out of the treasury. That's the limitations. And the widow indeed would be a needy saint. She, remember, was destitute. She wasn't, you know, having an abundance of, you know, accounts that her husband left her, etc. So there's very clear, very strict funneling when it comes to the Lord's money. Support an evangelist. Support needy saints. And then when you consider all of that, there are people that will take the Lord's money and they'll say, you know, let's go form the... There in Africa, there used to be a Church of Christ hospital. They changed the name of it. I'm not sure if they changed the funding. I couldn't find it. But there was a Church of Christ hospital. In the U.S., there are Church of Christ orphanages. There are Church of Christ widows' homes. There are all these organizations that have been filled. There are Church of Christ pantries. Where do you read about that in the Bible? Nowhere. It's not the Church of Christ savings and loan. It's not the Church of Christ pawn shop. It's none of those things that we read about in the scriptures. It was about helping needy saints. Think about what you do. And I know this is a little bit broader in application. But it's the Lord's house. It's His money. He has oversight. There are people that get into debates. Shouldn't we help everybody that comes in the door and wants money? You know, last week, there was a guy that came in here and he wanted money. And he said he was at the UTEP game the night before. He still smelled the alcohol was strong. I was like, man, we know why you need money. And he said he got robbed. He's staying at the hotel over here. He has no car. He has nothing. I don't know. Did you really walk over the mountain to go to the UTEP game? Come on. You're not only drunk, but you're lying about various different things. And he wanted money. And I said, no, not going to help you. How about bus fare so I can get to somewhere to get help? And I said, I'm not going to give you a penny. And I said, you know, the congregation here can't do that no matter what your story is. And I explained to him in the back. I said, no, it doesn't matter what your story is. He kept, you know, embellishing his story. I said, there's only certain people that we can help, and you're not one of them. Can't help you. It doesn't matter what more you say. People will come in, I have three starving children, and I can't get a job. And it doesn't matter what story you give. We're restricted. And there's things implied in 2 Thessalonians 3:10. If any man will not work, how do you know when you meet a stranger whether or not they're a lazy bum? Even out of your own money, out of your own pocket. Let's not even talk about the treasury right now. You go outside and someone says, I'm starving. Can you please help me? How do you know you're not giving 10 bucks to a drug user? How do you know? How do you know you're not going to give them 10 bucks to go get a prostitute? Which, by the way, if you ever come out here during the day, you can watch happen 100 times on the corners all around the neighborhood. Don't ever come out and mow. It's terrible. They'll even approach you. How do you know you're not going to give 10 bucks to this guy to go get this prostitute that's going to come out of some house and stand on the corner for a few minutes and get picked up and dropped off? It's like Katrina always say, well, we know what they're doing. We're out here during the week sometimes. You can be amazed at what you see. How do you know you're not helping them do that? If any man will not work, neither should they eat. Implies, it infers, I need to know something about this person. I need to know something about this person's character. I ought not give them the money to go and do evil. Think about the principles of God. Whose prayers does God hear? Saints. His eyes and ears are over the righteous. 1 Peter 3 and verse 12. Let me ask you a question. This is the Lord's house. We are. That we'll collect today is his money. How are you going to take his money and give it to somebody he doesn't even hear? We know if any man be a worshiper of God, him God heareth. If any man be a sinner, what? No. John 9:31. God doesn't hear him. George read in class this morning, Isaiah 59 and verse 2. Your iniquities have separated you. Even when Israel was God's people, when they erred, he stopped giving them blessings. How can you take the pattern of the Bible, Old and New Testament alike, and think it's good to give God's money to somebody like that? He won't even hear their prayers. It amazes me how that's even a debate. You can't possibly go to the scriptures and argue that it's something that is a good work. It never has been a good work. It was never God's approach at all towards humanity. A fourth work is the work of edification. Is edification a work of the church? Look at Ephesians 4 and verse 16. Ephesians 4. In verse 16. Actually, let's look at 15 and 16. Let's keep the head of the church in this. Ephesians 4, 15 and 16 says, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up in him all things, which is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body fitly joined together and compacted that by every joint supplieth, according to the effectual working and the measure of every part, maketh increase of the body unto the edifying of itself in love. Edification is clearly a work of the church. And there are some things inferred in that. We come together. We edify one another. There are things that we see in the scriptures, like in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, for example. Verse 20 says, when ye come together, therefore, into one place, this is not to eat the Lord's Supper. Now, he's going to address their problem. They were coming together for division rather than unity and taking the Lord's Supper. But the key that I'm drawing from this context is you come together into one place. That's clearly a work of the church, coming together in one place. That doesn't need to be a home. It's inferred in verse 22 and 34 of the same chapter. That if they were hungry, let them eat at home. That infers they were worshiping somewhere other than a home. You can see that in Acts 20. They're meeting in some upper room of some place, not in a home. Met on the temple grounds in Acts 2, etc. So we have authority to meet somewhere that is not a home. The work of edification can be fulfilled. There are some things that are required to worship. Like in Acts chapter 20, we always talk about the Lord's Supper from this context, but in Acts chapter 20 and verse 8, in verse 8, there were many lights in the upper chamber when they were come together. If you need something to worship, it's embedded in the work of edification. Now, I want you to think about it. Aren't there some things that aren't? Like what happens when Jesus went into the temple and there were the money changers? He overthrew their tables. John 2:13-17. There's some things that clearly aren't necessary when it comes to worshiping. Again, prior to moving here, I talked to a congregation in Killeen, Texas. There's an army base there too, kind of interesting. And I talked to a congregation in Killeen, and they were meeting in a storefront. And I told them that I had given a year's notice, and this was before I even talked to Bill right here. I said I'd given a year notice to the congregation I was working with in Butler. I wanted to go somewhere and preach the gospel where there were challenges, talk to them, and everything was going pretty good in the discussions I was having. And then they brought up money. And I said, well, I'm not real concerned about money. If need be, I can work or I can gain outside support or whatever. And I said, so if the congregation there doesn't have money, that's even better for me. I'd prefer not make this about money. And he said this, it's not that we don't have money. He says, it's that we're taking every bit that we collect and putting it aside for a building. And I said, okay, at that time, there were like a little bit more than a handful of people there. And they're meeting in a storefront. That's expedient, right? I said, why are you worried about a building? You just told me that there's nobody preaching the gospel in Killeen. You told me that you were in desperate need of a preacher, that really none of the men there were good teachers. You're trying to talk me into coming sooner than a year. But you tell me that a building is more worthy of a cause than a preacher of the gospel? How are you going to get to the one need without the other? Well, but that's just what we've decided. I can't remember the amount. They had a good amount of money. I said, well, I'm not going to write other congregations and tell them I need support when you've got that much money in the bank. How in the world could I rightfully do that when you purpose the Lord's money toward a building? There is certainly authority for us to assemble in a public place. But aren't there a lot of things we better take into consideration? Like, are we putting where we worship ahead of teaching the gospel? How's that right? You know, when you look at the scriptures, I'm thinking of a congregation that's called the Brown Street Church of Christ in Akron, Ohio. When you walk into that building, I can't remember how many millions of dollars they spent on it, but it was millions. When you walk into that building, it is gorgeous. They've got chandeliers. I don't know how many lights are in those chandeliers. Hundreds, right? I mean, it's just amazing. They've got a projector screen that comes down out of the ceiling. They've got a control booth in the center. If I recall, it was in the center. It's like this thing. It's a control booth. It's like, whoa, I'm a gadget guy, you know. I'd have fun in there. I'd be, you know, they had all kinds of gadgets. They had full cameras all around the building so that they could watch all the cars. They had cameras down the hallways. And the guy in control of this control booth, I mean, it was huge. It was like, take that out, you could fit 20 more people in the auditorium. It was massive. Katrina and I went there, and we were amazed. I walked in the preacher's office, and I mean, whoo, he had better furniture in his office than I do in my house. And I asked him, I said, you know, all this Lord's money. He had a color laser printer, the kind that stands on the ground. I don't know if you know, but those are like $8,000. Easy. And the laser toner cartridges, oh, you're talking $300 a clip plus the drums. And he's printing 200 bulletins a week in full color. Now I want you to think about something. How do you look at 1 Timothy 5:3-16 and see that God doesn't even want his money to be used for widows until a last resort, even widows indeed? How do you read that and get to color bulletins? How? How do you read that and come to a perfectly sculptured yard? Chandeliers. An entertainment system that could be used. And see, we've got entertainment, right? Drives down the street all the time. Well, how could you come to the conclusion that an entertainment system that's, and that thing had to be close to 100 grand. I mean, I just know how much technology costs. That the multimedia projector that's mounted in the ceiling and has all these wonderful effects to it. And the pulpit is like, I mean, you just, it's amazing. How do you see? Now, we can't help you, sister, because you're 59 years old. Yes, you've been hospitable, you've been faithful, but we can't help you regularly out of the treasury because the Lord doesn't permit it. Hey, go buy a new riding mower. How do you get there? How do you honestly, as God's people, jump from can't do this to that's good? All under the title of edification. Let me tell you what you're going to do to that 59-year-old widow. You're not going to edify her by that lawnmower. You're not going to edify her by the chandeliers. You're not going to edify her by all the technology and the beautiful printed bulletins and all those other things. You're going to destroy her because she hears God says you can't help me, but you can mow the lawn and fertilize it and get it cared for. And you can do all those things, but not me. Because that's edification. Well, are we going out and eating the grass? How do you jump from here to here? There are serious abuses that occur with the Lord's money because people aren't thinking right. What happens if it's not of faith? Remember that lesson on the application of authority? If it's not of faith, it's sin, Romans 14:23. Where do you go to the Bible and jump from we have authority for a place to assemble to we have authority for a museum full of wonderful technology? Where do you get from A to B? When there's so many restrictions on the Lord's money already, how do you get so loose? How do you jump to these kinds of conclusions? No, sorry, I know your husband was a faithful gospel preacher, and I know you've dedicated your life to Christ, but you know you're going to have to get support from individual saints because the church can't be charged since you're 58. Brethren, we want you to know we've purposed $50,000 this week to new carpet. How's the two go together? You can't be honest. You can't honestly at all come to that conclusion. Look at Romans 8. I know in congregations that I've been in, the first place I ever preached, first thing they told me is, you know, when your voice comes across the system today, it's Bose speakers that we have in the roof. You know, often I had to turn off the mic like I do here sometimes. Other people can't be. I didn't need those Bose speakers that are wonderfully surround sound. And I mean, hey, if we're going to watch the Super Bowl, I guess we're set up. But they were just so happy. And the baptistry, man, that thing was state of the art. All we need is water, right? I mean, here's the Ethiopian eunuch. Here is a electronically controlled baptistry. No, that's not what he said. He said, here is water. What doth hinder me baptized? How do you spend 50 grand on a baptistry? A 4-foot kiddie pool will work. Why do you need a $50,000 state-of-the-art electronic baptistry? Romans 8, this is why, 4 through 8. So that the righteousness of the law might be fulfilled in us, who walk not after the flesh, but after the Spirit. For they that after the flesh do mind the things of the flesh. They that after the Spirit, things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God, for it is not subject to the law of God. Neither indeed can be. So then they that are in the flesh cannot please God. Gymnasiums, movie theaters, fellowship halls, carnal entertainment. People throw that under the work of edification. They really do. There are churches of Christ that have tons of forms of entertainment that the church uses the Lord's money to pay for. How? How do you jump to that conclusion? Edification is spiritual. It's accomplished through the Word of God. Acts 20 and verse 32. The Word of God was able to build you up and give you an inheritance. How do you jump from look at all these restrictions to, but when it comes to the work of edification, we can get out the Lord's checkbook and go crazy. And buy this and buy that and buy this and buy that. Brethren, there's a part of staying away from tradition that requires just pure honesty. And understanding you're using somebody else's money. I want you to imagine if you went to the bank tomorrow morning. And let's say you've got $10,000 in the bank. And you go to the bank tomorrow because you've decided that you really do want pink walls after I sold it to you today. You didn't want the purple, but you want the pink. And now you're going to want to know where I saw that chair online. I don't remember. Sorry. Oh, it was probably Amazon. Yeah, I think it was Amazon that I saw it. So you decide you're going to go to the bank tomorrow. And you're going to walk in and you're going to withdraw $4,000. You want the chair. You want the paint. And you're not going to go with the 200-inch TV, but a little upgrade's good enough. So you walk in and you fill out the withdrawal slip and you hand over your ID and the teller comes back and says, I'm sorry, you don't have $4,000 in your account. And you say, how much do I have? $50. What happened? Somebody stole my money. What if the bank said, no, we just thought we could diversify your funds better for you. So we took out some investments in foreign banks. You'll see the return in 15 years. What would you do? Would you be like, oh, okay. That's your money. It just got stolen. When we take the Lord's money and we do with it what we want, it's no different than what the bank just did to you. How do you think he's going to feel? How do you think he's going to respond? He said, you robbed me in Malachi 3 when they just didn't give what they purposed. What about when you really rob him? You know what it is when you take somebody else's money without their permission? It's theft. Even our world, as corrupt as our world is, sees that as theft. Shouldn't we the greater? I want to conclude with this. Look at John chapter 12. One time I thought about writing an article and titling it The Churches of Judas. However, I thought not many people would get it. John 12, 1 through 6. Then Jesus, 6 days before the Passover, came to Bethany, where Lazarus, which had been dead, whom he'd raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of them that sat at the table with him. Then took Mary a pound of ointment and spikenard, very costly, and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with odor of ointment. Then saith one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, which should betray him. Why was not this ointment sold for 300 pence and given to the poor? This he said not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the bag and bare what was put therein. When we take the Lord's money and we spend it our way, we're just like Judas. No different. So let's be cautious. We've got things that are clearly authorized. Clearly. And then a lot of things that are very subjective. I don't know about you, but I don't want to go to hell over a lawnmower. That's rather ridiculous. And I certainly don't want to look at a sister in Christ and say, no, ma'am. We can't help you because of restrictions on the Lord's money while announcing new carpet in the building. Let's be cautious. Some of these areas will be endless debate among our brethren. They really will. There are people that think the church needs this, although I always find it funny. They think it's necessary, but they won't spend a dime towards it. They think, well, I gave already. One time one person said, you know, all the people with the bright ideas about the Lord's money are the ones who give the least. Thankfully, I don't know what people give, or I would know whether that's true or false. But the person making that statement, they had a better idea than I do. And I'll leave it at that. It's the Lord's money. Whether you give $1, $100, or $1,000 to him, once you purpose it, it belongs to him. You better make sure, after it leaves you and goes to him, that you surrender the decision-making to him too. If you've got something you want to do with your money, remember what Peter said to Ananias? While it was thine own, was it not in thine own power? And when it was sold, was it not in thine own? If you want to do something with your money, do it. Once you give it to the Lord, let it be spent on his will. By way of invitation today, I don't see anybody that needs to hear what you have to do to be saved in this assembly that hasn't heard it before. If you've got questions, stick around. If you're a saint and you need our encouragement or a kick in the butt or whatever, we're going to stand, we're going to sing. Let us sing.